Y'all, we are back for another episode today, and I really want to focus on this idea of the sensory differences and the sensory experiences with eating. And I am so excited to have Britton Coleman on the podcast. Y'all might know her from Instagram if you're over there. She is the autism dietitian and just shares so many wonderful resources. It has a membership, but we're going to go through some questions today. Her training is as a registered dietitian, and she specializes in working with autistic kids. Welcome to a parenting space actually designed for you, where you can get answers about navigating a life that includes autism. I'm Dr. Tay, a licensed child psychologist and parental coach specializing in neurodivergent affirming care. I have supported hundreds of autistic children and their families and have been in the autism field for over a decade. And I know firsthand the impact autism can have. I was 12 years old when my little brother was diagnosed and my family had to learn how to navigate the autism journey. It wasn't always easy. 2 decades later, I now create resources and services I wish my family had, including this podcast. And I developed the whole family approach. On this podcast, of course, we will talk about autism, but we will also talk about your personal growth and well-being as a parent, supporting your non-autistic children, and sharing personal stories of other families so you know you're not alone. Quick disclaimer before we jump into today's episode. Anything shared on this podcast should not be considered clinical advice, and you should consult with your team of medical, mental health, and developmental providers if you need support. I think she is the perfect person to bring on the podcast. Britton, I'm so excited you're here today.
Yay, I'm so excited to be here. Thanks for having me.
Of course, of course. So let's do a little backstory to start us off of like, how did you even get to this point of becoming a registered dietitian and specializing in autism?
Like you, I have a sibling on the spectrum. So my brother, Barrett, he's 2 years younger than me, is on the autism spectrum. And yeah, he was diagnosed when he was 2, I was 4. And truly my interest comes from him. It's so interesting when you grow up with a sibling that has special needs, or you really learn so much about, there's so much that you just wouldn't see. So I learned so much about picky eating, and it wasn't something that I grew up wanting to be a picky eating dietitian. That was never my goal. It just worked out that way, I think, because I had a natural interest in it. And then I was able to see that growing up. Barrett grew up only eating 5 different foods, and that was just the way Barrett ate. That was just how it was. And so I never really thought much of it until I decided to become a dietitian. Just because I was interested in it, I always knew that I wanted to go into some kind of medical profession. And then when I started looking deeper into like different areas to go into, one time I mentioned in a class that I wanted to go into autism nutrition, everyone was like, excuse me, that's why? And why is it important? I was like, okay, this just confirms why I need to do it because it's so obvious to me. But they just didn't have the experience. And so I decided to go into this field and put my love of nutrition and my experience with autism together and help parents expand their child's diet in a sensory friendly way.
Yeah, I love it. And I know this from being on your podcast and our conversations that your mom is a psychologist. And so I'm curious with your brother, what you remember or what you guys have talked about since with having his 5 safe foods. Was that something that was like being worked on to try to expand his diet? Was it more accepted? Where did that kind of fall in the spectrum of supports?
That's a good question, because I definitely feel like there was a balance there. And I feel like sometimes there has to be a balance. So your whole life isn't revolving around feeding therapy 100% of the time, because that's hard for anybody. But he was in feeding therapy. He did work with a dietitian when he was younger to expand his diet, and they were able to expand. It's hard sometimes to prioritize feeding because you have all of these other pieces that are going on. So feeding was a focus. I wouldn't say it was the primary focus at the time for him, but we're still working on that. So sometimes he'll try something new and I'm like, yes, Barrett, that's so awesome that you've tried something new. But so it's still a work in progress. He's still has a lot of sensory aversions. And so it's not easy to try lots of new things. And I certainly understand, but he still works on it, which is really good.
Yeah, absolutely. This is a little tangential, but I'm just curious of language use in your family interactions now. How would Barrett describe, in terms of his autism, describe himself?
Yeah, it's so interesting you say that because I was just talking to him about this the other day. So he's in a group, and it's like an online group for autistic adults to help them with animation, to help them with voiceover acting, like lots of really cool things. And I was asking him about the group, and he was being so hesitant to like share anything. Mm-hmm. And I was like, what's going on? And I was like, are you enjoying it? And he was like, yeah, but I was like, can you just get it out? And he was like, I think that I'm in a different place than a lot of people in my class. And I was like, that's interesting. Do you mean like your animation skills? What do you mean? He was like, no, I actually mean like autism. And I was like, okay, yeah, I understand what you're saying. And he was like, I think we just are in different places. And I was like, that's a really interesting way to say that. And that's also very self-aware of him. We hadn't really talked about that in a long time. And so I thought it was interesting. And he was like, okay, that's fine. And I was like, of course it is. And he was like, but it's just different. And I was like, okay.
Yeah.
So it was interesting to hear him talk about that and have that self-awareness in a group of peers was interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I just was genuinely curious because some of it is we hear a lot of autistic adults who are very vocal and sharing their experiences and their preferences. But I know what my brother and I talk about, and I've been open about that on the podcast technically, which people if have listened to these episodes, I don't agree with this as a clinician, but his diagnosis was like removed. And so he didn't grow up like having that be part of his identity. He very much knows. We talked about it openly. So it's always so fascinating to be able to hear different adult experiences as well.
I think that is really interesting. And my brother's always had his diagnosis, but it's never been something that he really talks about or offers up to somebody unless it's like, I have autism. Sorry, that was awkward. Or like something like that. So he like, it's my autism. And I'm like, okay. But it's really not something that we like grew up talking about. It was always an open conversation and we would talk about it. It wasn't like,
right.
It wasn't a part of it, but it was never something that he cared to share much about. He doesn't care if I don't even know if he would say I'm autistic or I have autism. I don't know what he just says. I don't care.
Yeah,
it's really interesting. It's just his mind is just very blissful when it comes to that. He's barely on social media. It's just interesting.
Although then he went viral on
then
your
he went viral. Oh. And it's like a follow-up video to that viral one of me showing him that he went viral.
Oh, I've seen it because I loved it.
He was like, oh my gosh, this is crazy. And actually a few weeks ago, somebody recognized him at the doctor's office and they were like, are you Uncle B? And he was like, yes, I am Uncle B. Like, I saw you on TikTok. And he was like, oh my gosh. He was so like flattered. He couldn't believe it. My mom said he like couldn't even talk the whole like doctor's appointment because he was just like, am I famous?
Yeah.
Sure.
I mean, it like blew up.
Oh, yeah. So awesome. I love it.
All right. So I don't know. I keep these pretty conversational and I was curious about some of those things and some of the behind the scenes, but let's get into more like the sensory piece of even just talking about sensory experiences with foods and how that comes into play and what often is difficult for autistic kids.
Yeah, eating is one of our most sensory-rich activities. And when we're eating, we have every single one of our senses firing at the same time. And so that can either be incredibly overstimulating, which it is for a lot of kids, or if you have the right mixture of the sensory needs that you need coming in for the food that you're eating right then, I can talk about what I mean in just a second. It can be really calming to be able to get that sensory input from food. And so what I see a lot of times is that kids are trying to calm down their nervous system because they're in flight or fight all day long. And so they're looking from that, from food, because it is incredibly potent.
Yeah.
So what I mean by that, crunchy food can really help with that sensory input. So a lot of kids really crave that maybe bland or crunchy foods. that are going to calm down their nervous system. And that feedback of like really chewing, that crunchiness, is really helpful. Some kids really like chewy. It totally depends on the person. So they have these foods that are really safe that can also bring down their nervous system from this place of flight or fight. Now, the problem is with trying new foods is that the smell is new, the taste is new, it looks different, it has a different color, like all these things happen. And so it's just a recipe for overstimulation. And so a lot of times, autistic kids can't try. It's not just they don't want to. It's like they physically cannot because we are going into overstimulation so quickly. And on that point, a lot of people are like, it's a choice. If they just don't give them this food and they'll eat a healthier food later, it is absolutely not a choice. And in fact, those sensory issues are going to get a lot worse the hungrier they get. It's going to just really amplify it. And so we really have to think about the sensory impact of food and making sure that we are doing our due diligence to meet the child where they are at. Now, it can't just really stop there, because if we're only eating like beige and crunchy foods, we often can't get the nutrition that we need. And so there's this balance of helping kids expand their diet, but also helping them meet their sensory needs. Exactly. And so we have to do this in a really intricate way to help balance the nutrition and sensory piece.
I love this idea of it's an oversimplification, but in many ways, like those safe foods probably have regulatory components to them. It's the calming things and they're predictable. And then as we're trying to expand and we're going outside of those safe foods, a lot of times that becomes activating. And it's no different when, you know, any human is in fight or flight mode, or your nervous system is getting more dysregulated, you're not thinking about something like hunger, and you're not thinking about how you're going to consume this food. Your body actually shuts down biologically, and it's really adaptive. But I think if we just think about it as like they're being stubborn, they're not doing this, which is, we know it's not the case, but it's easy to go to that. Or you'll hear some of these, I'm sure you hear them, let's actually talk about them, these traditional parenting quips that you either hear on social media or sometimes like other providers will say that really don't understand this sensory element. What are some of those things that you commonly hear?
The first thing that comes to mind, we've already talked about they'll eat when they're hungry. That's just not true. Again, sensory issues do not go away with hunger. In fact, they get worse. Yep. But the other piece that I just hear is just get them to take a bite. Just take a bite and you can leave the table. And the problem with that is that taking a bite often goes far past a child's sensory threshold for that new food. And so now what has happened is that new food gets assigned this negative feeling. And they're like, not only do I not want to eat this food again, but I also now trust mom or dad less because they made me try something that I wasn't ready for.
So good.
And so we see a lot of stress come up around mealtime because kids are so worked up that they're going to become overstimulated. And it's understandable because a lot of the picky eating tactics that are recommended by the internet, by pediatricians, by whoever, your friend, are not oriented for sensory processing challenges.
Yeah, and are not affirming in their approaches either. Such a great point about it's almost like the relationship then disappears and the trust with eating disappears by forcing them to just take a bite or just try something. How do you balance some of the pressures of like, okay, they have a really restrictive diet right now, and like people being like, we've got to expand that. How do you balance that? Where is that sweet spot of working to expand it, but also just some of it is just accepting these are their preferred and safe foods right now?
Mm-hmm. What the parent wants is for them to get more nutrition. And there's a lot of stress behind that. You have so much stress as a parent wanting to make sure that your child is nourished, that they're getting the nutrients that they need to grow. And so a lot of times you're just really stressed and you just want what's best for your child. But unfortunately, that stress comes out at mealtime and you can feel it. It's thick. Yeah. And it's really just wanting the best for your child or whoever this is, your niece, nephew, grandchild. But I think that it's important that we do understand that A, feeding takes a long time. It takes a long time to learn to expand the diet, but also that everyone has their own sensory needs and they also have their own preferences. There are many foods that I don't like. And I think as a dietitian, people just expect me to love these things. I'm very particular about the foods that I eat. And if somebody were to force me to eat something or tell me that I had to eat something before I left the table, I'd be like, what? I just don't like that.
Yeah.
I do not like the texture. I do not like the taste. At the end of the day, sometimes a child is just going to have very real preferences that they don't like. But we also can expand. We want to have this gentle expansion to help kids explore and figure out what other textures do they like? What foods do they like? And give them the opportunity to expand. Because I think what can happen sometimes, I'm kind of sidetracking, but what can happen sometimes is that we just sit in the place, well, I just want my child to eat. And I love that because we do need them to eat, but we can expand too. So I think that there's like a gentle balance between there of, yes, honoring your child's needs, but also helping expand their nutrition and doing it in the right way. I would also say one of the first things that I usually have parents do to just reduce some pressure and just take a little load off, multivitamins are amazing and they can help us fill the gap while we're working on expanding the diet and at least take some of that pressure off yourself to be like, oh my gosh, they have to eat a new food tonight. They have to eat a new food tomorrow. Well, let's help them get a little extra nutrition. Let's take a breath and let's move forward in the right way, where we're not all incredibly stressed out and we're causing, again, that negative connotation to food. So sometimes we can do things to just give ourselves a little bit of, what's the word?
Grace?
Grace. Yes. Yeah. Some grace.
Yeah. I think it's so interesting to think about the parental mindset that comes into mealtimes and eating. And again, I think it's a lot driven by what we're consuming in terms of information. How do you usually navigate then the parents that have actually received input from maybe other people in the family or family friends, things like that, along the lines of you're a bad parent because you're accommodating, you're making them a picky eater because you're only providing X, Y, and Z foods? How do you usually navigate that piece?
Oh, it's so hard. I think that having a script for yourself ahead of time is really helpful because then let me just say it's really hurtful when someone does say that and you're working hard, you're following the right advice, you're trying to get in feeding therapy and somebody on the outside just chooses to say, if you just do this, or if they just came to my house for a week, they wouldn't act like that. And so usually what I say, let's prep ahead of time. If you can, if Thanksgiving's coming up, Christmas is coming up, you can prep. You can also, you can choose to make it a learning moment and you can share with them, but you can also totally protect yourself and just say, thanks for the feedback. We are working on it.
Yeah.
And just call it over. It's hard to do that. And I think sometimes you just have to accept that they don't know, they don't get it, and they probably are not going to get it in this moment. You can always choose to talk to them about it later, but you could say, hey, I wanted to follow up on our conversation, like the following week. This is what we're doing. This is what my child experiences. And you can talk about it if it's worth it. If it's not worth it and it's some random stranger, just leave it at that. But it is really hurtful when somebody says something like that, especially someone you care about that's in your family, but they probably just don't get it.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So let's talk about maybe some of the like common patterns you're seeing autistic kids, foods they typically eat, what that looks like, and bringing in some of these sensory elements and understanding.
Yeah, I would say the most common sensory profile, and what I mean by sensory profile, a lot of times I will walk the members in my membership through an activity. I'm figuring out, okay, let's take a look at your child's preferred foods. What do they have in common? Are there patterns? Sometimes there are and sometimes there aren't. We can't oversimplify it to say every child likes this food or this kind of texture. But it's really common to see beige and crunchy be like at the top of the list. And who doesn't like that? I definitely, when I feel overstimulated, a crunch really goes a long way for me. And I know that about myself, even like crunching on ice. I love that. A pita chip, like something really crunchy. And so I totally get that. But so it's really common. The beige and crunchy foods are super common. Sometimes we will see foods that don't require a lot of chewing, but this comes back to maybe a texture aversion, but it could also be like oral motor challenges. So like maybe the child doesn't have, you know, the muscle tone that they need to really actively chew, and it's just easier to drink something. And so we have to think about all of the different pieces that could potentially play into eating. And I like to dig a little deeper with the families I work with and be like, let's look at these, your child's own pattern. What might that tell us? So it's always good to dig a little bit deeper. And so I would say I see those two patterns pretty frequently. But for some parents who are like, I don't see a pattern at all, there doesn't have to be one. But then we follow, okay, if they like these certain foods, what is the sensory input of those foods? And let's try to replicate it with something else. Yeah. Can expand with something even like the same exact food, just a different brand, or the same exact food, just a different flavor or color. And so we really honor those sensory needs and work our way out.
Okay. And when you're thinking about sensory, I know you said it, eating integrates all of the senses, but what are common like factors you're thinking about? Like crunchy, we've talked about, but what are some other, like elements for parents to think through? Real quick, just a brief interruption, because I want you to know you don't have to navigate this journey alone. If you're in a place where you have concerns about your child's development, you've been on the search for a therapist that provides evidence-informed neurodivergent affirming care, or you're needing more support as a parent, the whole family approach may be a good fit for you. Autism doesn't just impact your child's life, so you deserve care that works for your child and your whole family. Head to the link in the show notes to schedule a complimentary call where we can chat about your unique circumstances. We can help you decide if Dr. Tay Concierge Clinical Care would be a good fit for your family. And if not, we will provide you resources for your next best steps.
Yeah, texture is number one. We have like very clear research even to back that up. And even without that, I think most parents can say, yeah, texture is a big one. Temperature, color, the taste, if something's sweet, salty, bitter. And we also have the shape that a food is cut in, or if it's really thin or if it's thick, that can also affect your mouth movement whenever you're eating that food. It could also be like, okay, some kids really like things in the same shape every single time and that feels comfortable. So it really can be any like factor of the food. Actually, just last week we were talking on Instagram, I was talking with my followers about like frozen food and like the temperature variable and how temperature can be something that a lot of kids either really like extreme temperatures, like frozen or super hot. And some kids only like more room temperature foods. But with frozen foods, then we bring in some consistent variables like texture that's going to stay the same every single time. And so a lot of parents like, oh my God, I just realized my child loves frozen foods. I wonder if it's like the consistency with the texture or the extreme temperature. So sometimes there's all like you just have to think about those multiple variables.
Yeah. And I know like fruit, for example, fruit can be very unpredictable, like depending how ripe or not ripe it is, versus a lot of times frozen fruit, it's like reliably predictable, right? You get the same kind of crunch every single time. I remember someone explaining that to me and I was like, oh, that makes a lot of sense. The predictability of it.
Definitely. I think predictability when it comes to food is a big factor because a lot of processed foods or fast foods, they're the same every single time. And so that helps us know what to expect. And so a lot of kids will start to prefer fast foods and processed foods because they are the same every single time. We may even get into like brand specificity, where they have to have one particular brand because they know that it's going to meet their sensory needs. It's going to be predictable every single time. And that's hard for a parent to try and expand from there. But I think when we understand where the child is coming from, and again, that they're not just choosing to be picky, that there's a lot more deeply rooted. There's more than that. I think it gives a lot of empathy toward the child as well.
For sure. And I often think of a lot of times in many different ways that autistic kids are like super sensors. What's coming to mind for me, I don't know if you've ever watched the show, but Young Sheldon, and there's an episode where the bread like recipe changes and he's like asking everyone in his family, is this different? They're all like, no, it's not different. He ended up doing a full on deep dive, but it's like those small things. I think it was like they ended up adding one ingredient different. And I see that a lot in my practice too, where sometimes it's what is going on here. You were talking about whole, but literally I was at a kid's school today and his like aide was saying she peeled string cheese for him and he like refused to eat it, but he'll eat the string cheese like as a whole thing. And it was like, oh, okay. Like it's changed its shapes. I was also talking a little bit about like gestalt cognitive processors. Like they have a way that they like it and they don't want it to vary from that. And they like it to be whole versus parts sometimes. I think stopping and like reflecting on some of these things can help to also find those patterns.
And if you just think about the different sensory experience that you would get with a whole string cheese versus peeling, it is very different. That changes the texture, that changes your mouth feel, that changes the shape. And now it's rigid and torn and it's not even. There's so many things that changes. Yeah. So I think that's also a good point that sometimes like a child might not be accepting a food because of the way it's prepared right now, but we can switch up small things and we may be able to find something that the child does feel comfortable with. So oftentimes with parents, I'm even talking about, okay, they like this food. Let's say it's carrots. They like carrots. Why don't we change up carrots? We cut them differently, or maybe we can try different ways of cooking it, or maybe we can add a little bit of different spice or whatever it might be. Now, if a child only likes one food or like a few foods in a very particular way, we're not trying to trick them. We never, ever try to trick them. And we try to be as upfront about everything as possible. So if a child did like carrots one specific way, I would prepare them the way that they liked it in like a very obvious spot on their plate and like the biggest amount. And then in a separate, obvious, smaller spot, we would have it prepared in a different way. So we're not trying to say, ooh, we're going to try and see if they won't notice that I prepared this differently. Like we're being upfront about it. And that's also going to help them build more trust in you that you're not trying to pull something over on them as well. I also say that with the soup, like you were saying with young Sheldon, like we're not ever trying to sneak stuff in a child's like safe foods either, because the odds are they're going to detect it and they're going to lose a lot of trust in the food and in you, and they might drop that really nutritious food. And now we're like, we are trying to make steps forward, but now we've taken a lot of steps backward. And so I'm always very upfront with kids when it comes to food. We never want to be like trying to sneak things or change things up too drastically.
No, that makes sense. So talking about like food therapy or like exposure for food, you started like mentioning some of those ways, but what else, like in terms of that progression, are you often thinking about?
Since food is so sensory oriented and everything happens at once, what's really helpful is when we break it down. There is a whole hierarchy of our senses when it comes to eating. And there's this approach called the SOS approach to feeding, and it was developed by a psychologist. And I love this approach to feeding because it really takes into account different sensory needs and also follows the child's lead instead of using a more behavioral approach to it, which I believe that sensory model really needs to be honored for kids. So what we do is start with one sense and we work on that and build up like every sequential step. And so sometimes what we'll start with is talking about the food. We can see it. We can look at it. And the sensory input of that is very low compared to putting it in your mouth and chewing it. So we could talk about it. It could be on the table for some kids who feel overwhelmed with the food being nearby, maybe being able to smell it. It might be across the room. If that's still not doable because some kids might have some extreme anxiety around food, we can watch it on YouTube. We can do other things where it takes it one step back. Actually, the way that Barrett tried raspberries for the first time was because we played Pokemon Go together and you feed their Pokemon raspberries. And we were talking about it. And I was like, Barrett, have you ever tried a raspberry? And he was like, now that you say it, no. I was like, okay. I was like, what do you think about that? And we talked about the sensory input of it. And he ended up trying one and really liked it. And it was because he saw it on their screen first. It was something that he was interested in, the Pokemon. And we were able to introduce it in a very gradual way. But I think sometimes taking a step back can be really helpful. And then moving forward as you're able to, again, looking at it, you can smell it. You can touch it with something other than your hands. You can touch it with your hands. There's so many varying degrees to which you can interact with the food. There's actually over 30 different steps from seeing a food for the first time to actually eating it. In the SOS model, the SOS approach to feeding, that breaks it down. And so I think that's also really tangible for families who are working on it, because a lot of times we just go straight to eating it. Can you eat it? Can you chew it? Or whatever it might be. And it really helps us follow the child's lead on that. So I definitely say break it down and use it like building blocks. And as your child becomes more comfortable, the closer we can get to actually eating the food. But it's really important that we're listening to the child while we're doing that.
Yeah. And just to point this out, I guess two things that come to mind I'd love for you to comment on is, one, this takes time to work through all of this. And two, talk a little bit about like each of those steps, like what's the parent's response supposed to be if the kid isn't engaging?
Okay. So to give some context, it takes typically 20 to 30 tries of a new food before a child actually decides if they are going to like it or not. It's a lot of trying the food. So it takes a lot to expand. It takes a lot to help a child feel comfortable with it. And so I think in the scheme of things, we need to realize like kids are probably not going to try things on the first time, and that's okay. I think changing our expectations as parents also helps us with our like nonverbal cues that we are giving off to kids at mealtime as well. And so knowing that it's a process. Just like you learn your alphabet and your numbers, you have to learn food as well. The other thing I would say is that our language is incredibly important around mealtime. And so it's really easy to get frustrated because you're like, oh, if you would only just try a bite, or you liked it last time. This used to be one of your favorites. It's so hard not to do that. And I totally empathize with parents. But the language that we use around food also really impacts how they feel about themselves and how they feel. Like sometimes there's like shame around eating and what's wrong with me? I don't like this food anymore. Something's changed. But it also just adds this anxiety around food, which any child of any age, if they feel anxious around food, we're not going to have a lot of progress. And so a lot of times, thinking about the language we use around mealtime and our stress can really help like that co-regulation at mealtime. Yeah. So I definitely think that's something to talk about.
Absolutely. And I just like where I was saying about supersensors with eating and consuming and experiencing food, most autistic children are supersensors of like their environment too. So if they feel the stress, they notice the nonverbals, all of this. And so some of it is regulating yourself as a parent before you're approaching this. Maybe it's, I think about it this way. If you've had a really stressful day, maybe today isn't the day to go and try the next step, right? It might be like, I don't have the capacity for this today. And that's okay too, to take a break and circle back around tomorrow when you can be a more regulated presence in this process.
Yes. Again, like going back to giving yourself some grace, you're balancing a lot of things. There's so many different, you don't have to be an expert in feeding. You don't have to be an expert in all of these areas. And we're just trying our hardest. And so I think sometimes relying on who is the expert and how can they teach me how to do this so I can offload all of this stress that I'm putting on myself and follow an easier way, I think can make it a lot easier for everybody. And I think sometimes also just having someone else tell you to give yourself some grace that you're doing a really great job, I think can go a really long way.
I agree. Yeah. So what would you say, hopefully, I know parents are finding value out of this, but say they're like, listen, like I have been thinking about feeding therapy, or maybe they're in feeding therapy, this maybe sounds like a weird question, but what might be some red flags for parents to look at? Okay, this isn't the most affirming, supportive approach, because not everyone specializes in working with autistic children and approach this in an affirming way.
I actually had a past client reach out to me and she was like, SOS, I need you to tell me that my gut feeling is right. And I was like, yes, okay, tell me. And she was like, our feeding therapist, we haven't been having a lot of success lately. And she said, how about we just go cold turkey on his safe food? Stop giving him the safe food.
Sorry.
I know. And I'm like, oh my God. Yeah.
Yeah.
No. And she was like, I need you to tell me that's wrong, because right now I'm like feeling flustered and like frustrated and tired. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, I'm with you 1,000%. I agree. That is in the most respectful way. That is not what we should be doing. And I'm really worried that a lot more, he's going to lose a lot of trust in you and the practitioner and food, all of the things. We're probably going to end up in a worse situation. And that's just a recent thing that's happened. Cold turkey doesn't work. Again, like back to the, when kids are hungry, they will eat. They'll eat something new, or just stop feeding them X, Y, and Z, and they'll eat something healthier when they're hungry enough. The truth is that they will not. And unfortunately, a lot of kids end up in the ER with malnutrition or severe dehydration because they're trying to follow the advice that was, parents are trying to follow the advice that was given to them.
Yeah.
And I think if something feels wrong in your gut, it probably is.
Yeah.
Another thing is like forcing a child to take a bite before they can get a preferred, do a preferred thing. That's, again, we're just completely going past their sensory threshold and just not listening to the child. So again, this is why I prefer the SOS approach is going to be typically done by a speech therapist or occupational therapist. I see that these kind of approaches, people who are trained in the SOS approach, are typically more trained in sensory needs and autism, but no speech and occupational therapist just automatically comes with like the feeding therapy background. And so I think a lot of people just assume, oh, my speech or occupational therapist, they can do feeding therapy. And usually they'll say, sure, we can introduce feeding. And then if they're not trained, we're going to do more harm than good. And so I think if you are going to do feeding therapy, really making sure that you're looking into their background, that you can ask for their credentials when it comes to feeding, ask them what they would do in this scenario if they weren't having any success, because I definitely want to follow more of the sensory approach than the behavioral. I just don't feel like the behavioral approach honors the sensory needs.
Love it. Also, I'm so in alignment with this, like, for sure. So anything else before we talk about, because I want to give you the opportunity, if parents are like, okay, I'm learning so much, I want to keep learning from you, but anything else that's coming to mind for you that is, oh, this feels important to share?
Yeah, I would say a lot of families come to me and they're like, my child has extreme gut issues, mm-hmm. and they're also a picky eater. I think that's a lot of times parents don't realize how much the two are connected. And so I work with a lot of families who have kids with chronic constipation or other gut issues, that when we can work on the diet, that's something that can really help make toileting so much easier. And so I think that's a common reason or common questions that people have wrapped up in that. And it's hard to break that cycle because it can cause more picky eating because they feel uncomfortable, and then it can feed into the cycle. So I'd say if you're experiencing that, it's a great time to start considering expanding the diet, because that can really help with their stomach too. At the end of the day, what I just want for all families is to have a kid who is feeling great in their body, and that just makes their life so much easier. I don't know about you, like when I have felt sick and my stomach is hurt and I feel fatigued, like I can't focus in therapy. I can't focus at work. Like I can't do anything. And so for these kids who are coming from a place of just not feeling well, low energy, they like can't focus, like all these things, I just want kids to feel good. And so figuring out what that takes to help them feel good. And then that trickles over into all these other areas of life where they can focus better because they feel better and they can go to school with energy and like be able to participate in a way that feels really good to them. I just say that I think parents come to me oftentimes and they're like, I don't think he's ever felt well. And it's like a thing that's, it's really sad and it's true a lot of times. And unfortunately, I think sometimes, oh, I don't want to throw pediatricians under the bus again. I feel like I can do that, but
I always say it's not their fault. They just don't get a lot of training, all of this, especially in autism. It's our systems failing our pediatricians, honestly.
1,000%. So it's like these kids who are like being medically underserved because they're like, oh, constipation's common. Oh, picky eating's common. They'll grow out of it, or that just is what happens in autism. And it's, if you feel something's wrong, like you're not being honored and your child isn't getting the support they need, like by all means, follow your gut on that for sure.
For sure. And I also think, just to point this out, and this is a little controversial, but this is where some of the debate lies in the field of like diet and curing autism. And I'm open on this podcast, like we don't cure autism, but you can see improvement from diet. And it's no different than any human being. When we're fueling our body, right, and figuring out what's working for our body, we're more regulated and we're able to access then more of our skills and our gifts and all of that. And so we can see a big change in response to diet. Any thoughts there that pop up for you?
Yeah, I know. I think you explained that perfectly. And yeah, you'll never hear me talk about curing or reversing. I think that those are really harmful terms and expectations in autism. You'll never hear me talking about that. But what I do want is just for kids to feel good. Just like you said, when we can get the right nutrients, when we can really help our brains, our bodies, our gut get all those nourishing nutrients, anybody is going to feel better and be able to perform better at work or at school or in a therapy, whatever it might be.
Yeah.
And so sometimes I just think of it as like lightening the load for a child who has a lot on their plate already, being able to just make one area of their life a lot easier where they can just move through life easier is, I think, a really special part of what I do and get to see. But yeah, so diet can play a huge role. And I think one important thing for people to realize, the gut-brain connection is huge. And so when we talk about the gut and the brain, we talk about how our gut health impacts our brain health. And so we have very clear research studies to talk about how important that is when it comes to autism. And our gut is a huge place of like trillions of bacteria that break down our food and help us get those nutrients out of our food, create neurotransmitters. Like there are lots of things there. So when we can get the right food in there and the right bacteria, this is a whole nother hour of like,
you're right.
But yeah, it helps our brain as well. So there's, and again, that's not just autism. That's anxiety, depression, or just like anybody. It's a really interesting topic for sure.
It is. It absolutely is. So let's talk about your 5-day food challenge coming up. Talk a little bit about that in case parents are interested in jumping in.
Yeah. So what I will be hosting is a free 5-day event. And basically what the experience will be, I will be walking you through how to understand your child's sensory needs and preferences around the foods that they will eat, and then how we can utilize those to expand their diet. So again, always listening to our kids, but breaking it down in the right way. I have lots of very particular ways that I help parents do this so that we can appropriately expand their diet, because we have to start with where your child is and what their needs are and honor those preferences. So this 5-day event will walk you through each of those steps, breaking down the diet, and then help you understand how to move forward. And I'm really excited about it. I've never hosted anything like this, so I can't wait. And if you want to sign up, you can go to autismdietitian.com, and I will have lots of information on how to sign up there or on Instagram as well.
Perfect. And we'll also link it in the show notes so people can scroll down, click it, all of that. And then what way, this is an amazing event that you're doing. What are other ways that you typically work with families?
My membership is how I support all of the families that I work with. So if you're looking for support from me, want to expand your child's diet, help them get more nutrition, learn more about supplements and labs, like what should you know? What is research-based? I have an extensive library inside of the membership, and I support families in there every single day. And it's a really cool place for parents to connect to And that's called the Nourishing Autism Collective. And you can join there at nourishingautism.co.
Awesome. Awesome. And then your Instagram, Autism Dietitian, where else can people find you?
Instagram, YouTube, TikTok, Facebook, all the places. Okay. Yeah.
Awesome. Awesome. I think you give so many amazing resources. You have your podcast as well. The name of that is?
Nourishing Autism. Yeah.
Okay. I thought so. Okay. I didn't want to say the wrong thing. So lots of different resources. And I love how you really curate this to families that have an autistic child. It's hard sometimes to find resources that are specialized to autism. And so just love what you're doing.
Thanks so much. I appreciate it. And thank you for letting me be here. I'm so glad that we got to swap episodes. I'm excited for yours as well.
I know. I agree. It's so much fun and so great to connect. But awesome having you here. Thank you so much. And that is a wrap for today's episode of Evolve with Dr. Tay. I will see you back here next time.
Before we wrap up this episode, for real this time, I want to share a couple ways you can get even more value and what your next steps could be. First, join the Evolve Facebook group. We do Q&As about the episodes and so much more. I linked that group, my personal social media pages, and any resources I mentioned in this episode in the show notes. So scroll down now and join me online. When you submit questions on any of my pages, your question could be featured on this podcast. How cool is that? I love being able to speak on topics that feel directly relevant to your life. Your questions truly make a difference in the content we create here. One last thing, do your fellow autism parents a favor. Share this episode on your social media and tag me. Autism currently affects 1 in 36 families in the United States and many more worldwide. So I'm sure there is a parent in your social media followers that could be served by this podcast. Thank you again for being here, and I'm so grateful we shared this time together. Bye, y'all.